Today, the island of Sicily is a beautiful place to visit. But in the summer of 1943, it was anything but idyllic. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you'll hear from eyewitness participants in what the U.S. and our British allies dubbed Operation Husky, the first step in liberating Fortress Europe from Adolf Hitler's Nazi legions. Listen carefully to the men who made history during 38 terrifying days in July and August of 1943. Sadly, many of those we interviewed for this production are no longer with us. Here's some background. In the spring of 1943, nearly a year and a half after the U.S. had entered World War II, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and President Franklin Roosevelt met at Casablanca. They decided the only way to keep the Soviet Union in the war was to attack Hitler's so-called Fortress Europe. That's how Operation Husky, the first joint amphibious assault of World War II, was decided. Husky brought together George S. Patton, Bernard Montgomery, Dwight Eisenhower, and General Harold Alexander. But the friction among these men threatened the success of the invasion right from the start. Husky was the first American airborne operation of World War II. Listen to courageous paratroopers Edwin Sayre, Timothy Dias, and Delbert Kuhl describe how they fought off German armor. You'll be awed. Tragically, they also watched in horror as 81 of their fellow paratroopers and 60 C-47 pilots and aircrewmen perished when they were shot down in one of the worst friendly fire incidents in history. You'll also find out how 120,000 German and Italian troops under the command of Field Marshal Albert Kesselring managed to slip away across the Messina Straits to fight again all the way up the Italian boot. But wait, that's for another podcast. Right now, listen to the voices of the American heroes who fought to liberate the island of Sicily, broke the back of Hitler's alliance with Mussolini, and started the beginning of the end of the Third Reich.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/war. That's ZipRecruiter.com/war. One more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/war.
Welcome to War Stories. I'm Oliver North. We're at the American Armored Foundation Tank Museum in Danville, Virginia. In the summer of 1943, M4 Sherman tanks like this one were battling unexpectedly German Mark IV Panzers on the narrow roads of Sicily, the largest amphibious assault up to that point in World War II. The invasion force, some 500,000 American, Canadian, and British soldiers, sailors, and airmen were pitted against more than 325,000 well-prepared Italian and German troops occupying terrain that lent advantage to the defenders. The invasion of Sicily was the first assault against Hitler's Fortress Europe. It brought together commanders like Patton, Montgomery, Eisenhower, and Alexander, men whose leadership ultimately won the war. But as you'll see tonight, the friction between them threatened the success of the endeavor right from the start. For the Allies, the lessons learned were a bloody test of leaders, troops, tactics, and equipment that would be used next on the continent. First in Italy, then 11 months later at Normandy.
In 1942, inexperienced American troops had suffered huge losses during Operation Torch in North Africa. The U.S. took some 6,000 casualties at the Kazarine Pass. Some even called it a massacre. General Dwight D. Eisenhower found Major General Lloyd Friedenall unfit for command and turned to a nearly 60-year-old general named George Patton
for new leadership. The battle-hardened British Army under the command of General Bernard Montgomery was revitalized after a stunning victory at Al Alamein against Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. The experienced British 8th Army looked at green U.S. troops as being second-rate. Despite the growing animosity between the Allies, the question still remained, where should they strike next?
Headline, Roosevelt and Churchill confer at Casablanca.
By the time President Franklin Delano Roosevelt arrived in North Africa in 1943, British and American military planners were already divided over strategy. With the U.S. fighting a two-front war and production exploding, Roosevelt chose a wait-and-see approach for future operations. But Prime Minister Winston Churchill disagreed and argued for a vigorous campaign against the soft underbelly of the Third Reich, the Mediterranean.
The British showed up at the Casablanca conference well-prepared. They had great communication. They had done all their staff work, and they all agreed on what they wanted.
Ed Ruggiero is a former Army infantry officer and the author of Combat Jump.
Ed, tell me about the planning for the Sicily operation.
The Americans showed up not in agreement. One of the senior officers who participated said, we pretty much showed up at Casablanca and participated in a British-run presentation.
Eisenhower and George Marshall, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, never really wanted to be in the Mediterranean.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Carlo d'Este is a military historian and the author of Bitter Victory.
They thought it was a dead end. They thought it was a peripheral operation that was going to contribute nothing to the ultimate military operation that we needed to win the war, which was to invade France.
At Casablanca, Churchill persuaded Roosevelt that this was the way to go.
And it was decided that the Allies would continue military operations in the Mediterranean.
Their target, the island of Sicily, north of Tunisia and the gateway to Italy. For centuries, these shores were conquered by countless invaders.
The Greeks established the first modern civilization, followed by the Romans, followed by the Saracens, Muslim invaders. Mussolini, in fact, had to conquer it. He came down with a vengeance on the mafia in Sicily, and were pretty much in charge of everything. So the Sicilians were not in love with the government in Rome.
Since 1922, Benito Mussolini, who called himself Il Duce, the leader, ruled Italy with an iron fist. Once a school teacher, Mussolini promised to restore the glory days of the Roman Empire to his homeland. Il Duce aligned himself with Hitler's Germany with a pact of steel signed in 1939. But after heavy Italian losses in North Africa and Russia, this alliance quickly began to unravel.
Mussolini was tottering on the verge of being run out of office. The Italians had suffered one setback after another. Hitler was the dominant part of the so-called Pact of Steel. The Germans viewed the Italians with complete disdain. They had no faith that the Italians could really do much of anything.
Dubbed Operation Husky, planning for the invasion of Sicily was plagued with problems from the start.
It was actually planned in five separate locations. In addition, General Sir Harold Alexander, who was the Allied ground commander-in-chief, was totally distracted by the war in Tunisia, which was going very badly in early 1943.
But Alexander wasn't the only one preoccupied in Tunisia. So were Patton and Montgomery.
By the time Montgomery comes on board and can really devote his time to it, he steps in and realizes this is just all bollocks up and there's no way this is going to work. So he comes up with the plan himself.
According to the legend, Montgomery hatched his plan in a bathroom in Algiers during an impromptu meeting with Eisenhower's chief of staff, Major General Walter Bedell Smith.
The plan he came up with happened to feature the British in the leading role. The British are going to land near Syracuse in the southeast corner of the island and make a run up to Messina. Patton and his troops and the American troops are going to land to his left and essentially protect the left flank of the British Army. Now, this is in keeping with Montgomery's overall opinion of American combat forces, which wasn't all that high.
So there were some very bad feelings that were stirred up very early in the campaign. And they all keyed back to the fact that there wasn't a firm hand on the steering wheel.
While the Allies squabbled over how to invade Sicily, Hitler and his high command fell for a modern-day Trojan horse. The deception concocted by the British was designed to deceive the Germans into believing that the next Allied strike would be in Greece, not Sicily.
They called this Operation Mincemeat. They planted the body of an alleged Royal Marine major carrying very sensitive documents. The documents were real, but the information in them was false. And then they dumped the body off the deck of a British submarine off the southern coast of Spain. The idea was that the corpse would float ashore and that the Germans would ultimately find out what those plans were.
It worked. An entire panzer division was sent to Greece from Europe in anticipation of an Allied landing that never took place.
It was one of the great deception operations in military history.
Stage one of Operation Husky required the 82nd Airborne to perform their first military jump behind enemy lines.
Who makes the decision to try the airborne for the first time?
George Marshall, right at the top of the whole war effort in America, was a big believer in the possibilities for the airborne. Eisenhower, who's going to command the overall Allied effort, is not a believer. But the airborne commanders, Matt Ridgway in particular, is a big proponent of the airborne. And he manages to persuade both Bradley and Patton. And Patton, who's always won for more combat power, another combat multiplier, says, let's give him a try.
One of the paratroopers poised to jump out of his C-47 was 25-year-old Edwin Sayre from Breckenridge, Texas.
How did you end up going to jump school?
I heard about this paratrooper outfit, and it sounded very interesting to me. And the $100 a month extra really sounded interesting.
Tell me about your first jump.
I won't say that I wasn't scared. You just have to overcome a little fear. And I think this is one difference between a paratrooper and a regular. At least one time we proved we can overcome fear.
Ed Sayre and the rest of the untried green paratroopers would soon have to overcome their fear again, this time in combat.
I looked out the door of my plane and I saw that we were in the wrong place.
3,400 paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne make their first combat jump behind enemy lines. Almost nothing goes as planned. Find out why when War Stories continues. After victory in North Africa, the Allies debated where to launch the next offensive. But by the spring of 43, the island of Sicily was selected as the target for Operation Husky.
Operation Husky was the first major amphibious operation carried out by the Allies, and it ultimately turned out to be the second largest amphibious operation in history.
For the invasion, the Allies assembled a vast armada of more than 2,500 ships. One soldier who stood in awe of the fleet was 25-year-old Ed Spears from Oklahoma City.
You could see ships just about as far as you could see, clear to the horizon.
But before the Armada could set sail from ports in North Africa, the arduous task of loading the ships had to be carefully orchestrated.
We had to put the order of battle into the loading of the ship.
And, First on, last off.
Yeah.
And that's important because loading ships and unloading ships in amphibious operations are critical.
It took 87 hours to load, and that was continuous. None of us slept.
29-year-old Detroit native Clem Van Wagner pitched in loading equipment for the Big Red One.
They asked me to load the vehicles and organizational property of the 18th aboard Liberty ships.
You're basically responsible for loading everything, weapons, vehicles, people aboard the assault ships for an entire regiment.
Yes.
That's a handful for a young lieutenant.
These enormous convoys steamed fully loaded across the Mediterranean. D-Day was set for 10 July 1943 and was to be spearheaded by some 3,400 paratroopers dropped from the sky. Their mission, hold the high ground above the beaches to be taken by the landing force.
Who sets July 10th as the day for the operation?
The date July 10th was picked for D-Day mostly because of moon and tide. The paratroopers needed moonlight. It turned out there was about 50% moonlight at that time.
The man chosen to command the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment was Colonel James Gavin. His well-trained paratroopers were in high spirits as they boarded C-47s to make their first combat jump at midnight. In the pitch-black darkness, wind gusts of 45 miles an hour threw the planes off course.
In training, you cancel anything when the winds are over 15 miles an hour because It's going to blow the airplanes, it's going to blow the paratroopers while they're in the air, and it can very easily drag a trooper across the drop zone, but this is not a training exercise, this is a combat operation.
I landed right in the middle of a grape vineyard. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face.
The chute barely opened when we hit.
Another member of the 505th was Brooklyn-born Timothy Dias.
I must have had a very bad concussion because I smashed into the ground. This was darkness at night and firing all over in the distance and planes overhead. In fact, one of the planes dropped the men and then went into the side of a hill and burst into flames.
80% of the paratroopers were dropped miles from their targets, but Colonel Gavin had given his men an order what to do if they missed their drop zone.
Basically, it said this. If you land somewhere and you don't know where you are, just find the nearest enemy and attack him.
So all these little groups of paratroopers start making trouble for the enemy. They ambush couriers, they cut telephone lines, they pick fights with anybody they can find.
We did not anticipate any tanks, particularly German tanks. It was a shock to us.
A deliberate decision was made by Allied headquarters to withhold intelligence from Colonel Gavin and the rest of the 82nd Airborne that Sicily was actually defended by the 15th Panzer Grenadiers and the Hermann Göring Division.
The high command knew the German armored division was in the vicinity of where we were going to jump. They didn't tell us that.
Of course, the last thing in the world you want is lightly armed airborne troops dropping into armor.
We just had to cope with it the best that we could. We were in a trench up there that we'd captured, and here comes the tanks. In the meantime, the 1st Infantry Division had given me a forward observer, so I told him, let's get some fire out there. They're going to overrun us here in this trench. It's better for us to be hit with our own stuff than for them to run over us with those tanks.
155s did a job on that armor.
But fortunately, 155 hit the lead big tank. Then it caught fire. The screams of that German crew from inside that tank, you could hear them for a half a mile. And then the whole thing exploded in front of us. That kind of dismayed the rest of the tankers.
Timothy Dias' men also fought courageously against the unexpected German tanks.
My bazooka team had knocked out the two tanks. This was a shock to the Germans. They didn't know we were there. It was a surprise to them because the colonel in command of the Panzer Group, it turns out, was sitting up in the turret of his tank, and the first shell hit right there and killed him.
Dias and his men found themselves pinned down in a ditch with potato masher grenades raining down on top of them.
They were throwing them down and we were throwing them up. This continued for a long period of time until that one tank turned its 88 up on us.
Trapped and outnumbered, Dias made the decision to surrender.
But it hurt, and it still hurts emotionally because we were trained, we were the best. And to have to surrender was a terrible feeling.
The men of the 82nd Airborne weren't equipped to battle heavy German armor like this, but they did, and helped keep Allied forces coming across Sicily's beaches from being pushed back into the sea. That's next on War Stories.
It was so dark, you didn't know when you were going to hit the ground. I just crashed.
On 10 July 1943, Colonel Gavin's scattered paratroopers and the British 1st Parachute Division jumped behind enemy lines to hold key terrain above the beaches of Sicily. Before dawn, some 80,000 Allied troops, led by Generals Montgomery and Patton, conducted the first joint amphibious landing of World War II.
We went with a huge convoy.
Guiding landing craft ashore from Subchaser 692 was 25-year-old Commanding Officer Edward Stafford.
Our job was to pick up a wave of landing craft, five or six loaded LCVPs, and take them into the line of departure which was 2 miles offshore, come back out, get another bunch and take them in.
Do you remember any of the charts at the time showing your landing beaches?
Our landing area was designated, but we were wondering if they were going to cancel because of the weather.
We got this horrible sea to go ashore in with all our weapons and stuff.
Eisenhower wrote in his book that it was just like the landing at Normandy, a very anguished decision.
If we try to delay it, we lose the element of surprise. That's a hell of a decision to make.
How in the world do you train men to take care of 10 to 20 foot waves and find a beach with rocks that they don't know about? When I ended up at 87 hours, I had one landing craft there.
Out of 33?
Out of 33.
Both the Germans and the Italians had decided there must be very rapid counterattacks, because once we got ashore, it was serious trouble for them. And this is why we had these sort of Custer's last stand type operations in the first couple of days of this campaign.
But the rapid counterattacks weren't just on the ground. They also came from the sky.
We just got started unloading and the Ju-88s come over and they dropped bombs and it didn't hit our ship. The ship next to us, they dropped one in the hole, and they had to abandon ship. They couldn't get the fire open.
One of those fighters hit an LST on the beach. You could see the smoke come up from her.
When you hit the beach, describe what the beach looks like at that point.
There was bodies, there was stacks of ammo, and the beach engineers were green. Everything was being offloaded just as fast as it could go.
But by the end of D-Day, Patton's 7th Army had penetrated an impressive 4 miles inland and had captured over 4,000 Axis soldiers. Mostly Italians were quick to surrender.
They were all smiling, and a lot of them said that we've got a cousin in Brooklyn.
But on D+1, Patton's troops confronted a more determined enemy on Biaza Ridge.
It sits right in between the two main invasion beaches, where the 45th Division came ashore and the 1st Division is now ashore. So somebody who controls this ridge could, in fact, split the American invading forces.
Facing the American troops was the entire Eastern Task Force of the Hermann Göring Division.
The paratroopers found themselves facing Tiger tanks with basically rifles and these inadequate bazookas, led by Colonel Gavin, who had rounded up anyone and everyone he could find, you know, whether it was cooks or whether it was airborne.
Gavin's courageous paratroopers held Biaza Ridge. But by the end of the day, the 7th Army had suffered over 2,300 casualties, the highest of the campaign, and Patton needed reinforcements for his battle-weary troops.
Patton says, well, let's bring in some more of these paratroopers because they're doing such a great job.
In the fog of war, Navy gunners mistakenly target the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment aboard U.S. C-47s en route to their drop zones. That's next on War Stories.
By the end of D+1 on Sicily, Patton's 7th Army had suffered a staggering 2,300 casualties and was desperate for reinforcements. He turned to Colonel Jim Gavin, whose paratroopers had successfully held Biaza Ridge.
Somehow these paratroopers find some reserve of strength, and at dusk on the night of July 11th, they push up and over the ridge and clear the Germans off Biaza Ridge.
On the evening of 11 July, Patton ordered 2,000 additional paratroopers to drop into Sicily near Gela.
There are two battalions of the 504th still in North Africa. So these two battalions load up in what should have been a milk run. They were going to jump inside Allied lines in a safe place.
Our colonel got up and he says, you train hard and I expect you to do a good job and I know you will. He says, now the chaplain's going to have a little time to speak with you. So we prayed together before we board the plane.
24-year-old Chaplain Delbert Kuhl was one of 2,000 paratroopers aboard the C-47s.
We went very low over the Mediterranean, a sliver of moon shining. As we approached Sicily, our Navy mistook us for Germans and shot down 23 of our planes. I stood in the door, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It looked like a mammoth 4th of July celebration. It was plane after plane went down the plane. They just zeroed in on the C-47s. And we couldn't get them stopped. Those were our friendly troops they were shooting at.
Now, what's torture for the paratroopers who are already ashore can actually see this going on, including Gavin, and we're powerless to do anything about it.
In a tragic friendly fire incident, 23 planes were lost and 37 damaged. 60 pilots and crewmen and 81 paratroopers were killed.
Communications have broken down between the Navy and the Air Force, and not all the Navy gunners knew that these could be American planes flying overhead.
There had been an air raid by the Luftwaffe and the Italian Air Force only an hour or so before. So the gunners were nervous. All it takes is one gun to fire mistakenly, and it's like a ripple effect. And that's exactly what happened.
Despite being hit several times, the pilot of Delbert Kuehl's C-47 managed to veer off toward the mountains.
We were losing altitude, so we had to get rid of the load. And the red light came on, which means get ready to jump, and almost instantly the green light came on. Sergeant Lee and I stand in the door, so I'm hollering, "No, no, no!" He saw the ridge coming up in the half moon. I landed right on top of the ridge. I got knocked out, I finally came to, and I ditched my chute and crawled down the ridge, down along a wall, and the first paratrooper down there had two broken legs. Next one had one broken leg.
Did First Sergeant Lee make it?
No, Sergeant Lee got killed. Wonderful man.
That first jump was a disaster.
That first jump was tragedy. We landed all over. But amazing, the Germans thought there was many more thousand paratroopers than there were, because they were all over the island.
Word of the horrific incident reached a shaken General Eisenhower. He immediately suspended airborne operations until completion of a formal investigation.
The word had gone out everywhere, do not fire. And yet Eisenhower blamed Patton, even though there was plenty of blame to go around.
By the second week of the battle for Sicily, Britain's General Alexander still hadn't given his two army commanders a clear strategy. Chaos ensued.
Both of these commanders, Patton and Montgomery, conducted operations pretty much according to the way they felt they should.
If you look at the map of Sicily, the obvious thing to do is to cut off the German Axis forces that want to escape, and the place to do that is Messina. So the thing is to get there as quickly as possible to cut off a retreat.
So ultimately, Messina was the real objective of the Allies. But unfortunately, Alexander never really stated it. So once ashore, you had two armies sort of moving inland without any real direction. There was an incident where the British, at Montgomery's instigation, took over a part of the front that belonged to the U.S. 45th Division.
We had the highway, and Monty took it over without telling anybody, and he put the 1st Canadian Division on it.
The Americans felt that they were much better equipped to have continued operations in that area, and that was correct. Patton and his subordinate corps commander, Omar Bradley, were firmly convinced that the U.S. Army was getting the short end of the stick and that something had to be done.
Patton concluded that the prestige of the U.S. Army was at stake. On 19 July, he wrote to his wife, "Monty is trying to steal the show, and with the assistance of divine destiny may do so. But to date, we've captured 3 times as many men as our cousins."
And so he created a bit of a ruse. He went to Alexander and he said, "Look, we need to cut the island in two." And he got permission to capture the port city of Palermo.
Between 19 and 22 July, Patton's 3rd Infantry Division marched from the southern tip of Sicily right up through some of the roughest terrain to capture Palermo, an astounding 54 miles in 33 hours.
And I'm saying to myself, "My God, that's General Patton." I couldn't believe it.
24-year-old Lieutenant Charles Scheffel was an operations and training officer in the 39th Infantry Regiment.
And he walked up. I said, "My God, what's a general doing up here on the front line, in effect?" So he said, "Well, we're going to let the armor through." And that became a famous statement in our division. That every time after that we'd see armor, we would always say, "Let the armor through! Let them do the fighting."
Patton's triumphant troops captured Palermo, Sicily's capital, on 23 July. And the U.S. Navy rushed into the port.
We were the first U.S. ship to come into the harbor at Palermo. There were wrecks all through the middle of the harbor. A ship that must have weighed 2,000 or 3,000 tons. Sitting not at the dock, but on the dock. It had been blown out of the water, presumably by an American air raid, and was sitting on the dock.
Did you tie alongside?
Tied up alongside. We got ashore, and that was a fantastic experience. That was the capital of Sicily, and it was a ghost city. There was not one person, not one sound. Silent, deserted, empty.
Patton got a little taste of being the conqueror in what is the capital of Sicily. So then he began this race across the northern coast, determined to beat Montgomery to Messina.
He said, we must stay on the offensive. This is the only way that we're really going to win this thing. Patton saw this as the key to show the world that these are good troops, that Americans fight well. And here's the proof.
The race to Messina was on, but who would get there first, Montgomery or Patton? Find out when War Stories continues.
Patton's 7th Army entered Palermo, the capital of Sicily, to throngs of adoring Italians on 24 July 1943. The next day, Benito Mussolini was removed from power.
Mussolini had been displaced. He was arrested. There was a coup to remove him.
But even with the ousting of Mussolini, the first Allied bombing of Rome, and the surrender of some 53,000 Italian troops, Hitler refused to relinquish Italy and ordered his army to occupy Rome. After 22 days of fighting near the port city of Catania, Montgomery's 8th Army failed to break through General Hans Hube's fortified lines.
German parachute division came in. There was some terrible fighting. And ultimately, 8th Army became almost stalemated.
With Monty's army bogged down, General Alexander gave Patton the green light to head for Messina. Patton wrote, "This is a horse race in which the prestige of the U.S. Army is at stake. We must take Messina before the British."
Patton's plan was to turn his army along the north coast and head for Messina. So while Montgomery headed up the eastern coast, he was going to head up the northern coast. Eventually, at least in Patton's mind, it became a race. But as far as Montgomery was concerned, it was never a race.
A fired-up Patton was determined to get to Messina any way he could.
There were a series of little amphibious landings as you went up the coast on the north side. Did you guys do any of those?
Yes. Now, we had one horrible accident there. Boat turned upside down. We lost 16 men there. So that was the biggest casualties we had in that company in all of Sicily. 16 men killed at one crack.
It wasn't entirely successful, but it was a means of disrupting the Germans. They were using this terrain throughout Sicily to draw as much blood as they could.
Because it's so mountainous, it's easier to defend than it is to attack. Patton, you know, is all about dash, but you're not dashing through the mountains.
German and Italian forces went to great lengths to stall the American advance to Messina, even detonating bridges and roadways.
You had the mountains on one side, and the sea on the other, and two single roads running to Messina from the direction of Palermo.
Tell me what that road is like going up north.
The Germans sheared off the road. There's a cliff like this, and there was a road that was cut into that rock, and the Germans just blasted it off.
We were going up one canyon one time. The place was cut up.
Our engineers came in and, on the wreckage, built bridges and stuff to get us through. It was incredible. Engineering was incredible.
The 1st Division faced their most difficult battle of the whole Sicily campaign on the roads leading to the mountain village of Troina. Axis forces hidden in the surrounding hills pounded American troops with artillery fire.
They fought some very bloody small unit actions where casualties on both sides were exceptionally heavy.
The battle for Troina began on 31 July and raged for 6 days. Charles Scheffel's regiment was attached to the 1st Infantry Division.
We've been trying to capture this town of Troina. And I said, well, I think the only way we're going to take that town is to knock out the bombs. What we can't do with a rifle or a bayonet.
Wave after wave of P-51s dropped 500-pound bombs on Troina to blast the Germans out.
P-51s came right over our head, and they dropped their bombs all over that town. we launched our attack. A couple days later, I was on my radio, and I get a call. It's something like this. I thought you'd like to know that the outfit that bombed Troina the other day is the first black group of pilots to be in combat.
Some of those pilots were the Tuskegee Airmen.
I said, I don't know what their color is, but you tell them that the 1st Battalion thanks them for what they did, because we just walked in.
Following a week of fierce fighting, with 1,600 of his men dead, Patton's 7th Army was now ready to advance on Messina, but it was going to be painfully slow.
It wasn't possible that we could use another airborne drop at this stage. So the end result was we had to slog, basically 1 mile at a time.
Find out how 2 slaps almost ruined General George Patton's career. That's next on War Stories.
Despite the horrific terrain, by 17 August, Patton's 7th Army had advanced nearly 60 miles in 11 days to end the race to Messina. A triumphant Patton was ecstatic to have captured the city before Montgomery. He made sure that Ed Spears and the men of the 45th Infantry Division were recognized for their part.
General Patton said, "You deserve to be in on the end of this fight." And Patton then said to the 3rd Division, "You will take the 45th Infantry Division into Messina with you." So they stuck us off on a hill and sent a patrol into Messina. And we claimed we were in there first, and 3rd Division claimed they were in there first. But that was how Patton gave us our share of the glory.
But Patton's competitive nature wasn't lost on his troops.
How'd you beat the British to Messina?
Well, Patton had quite a lot to do with that, I guess. I guess they took too many, whatever you call them, to take them
there. T-breaks.
Yeah, that's my impression of it.
But by the time Patton's troops entered Messina, General Hube had already pulled off the impossible.
German commanders pulled off what they set out to do. They escaped to Italy with most of their movable equipment and almost all of their soldiers.
It was one of the greatest escapes, one of the greatest military evacuations that's ever been pulled off. Roughly 60,000 German troops, almost everyone who was still alive and able to go onto a ferry boat, was evacuated from the island.
And with them went an estimated 62,000 Italian troops.
Do you remember actually arriving in Messina and knowing that the Germans had gotten away?
Patrol went in, didn't see a damn German. 3rd Division didn't find any.
How long did it take the Germans to get across the straits?
Well, I wish we knew. But how in the hell they got 60,000 men out of there, I'll never know.
They had a ferry system. It was running better than the ferries between Staten Island and New York. I mean, every night, they were evacuating 100 here, 200 there. And in the end, the numbers were staggering. So this was the bitter victory that we harvested in Sicily. We won a military campaign, but we morally and in certain other ways paid a price for letting these people get away.
After Patton took Messina, the Sicily campaign was officially over, but his glory didn't last long. Hospital visits he'd made 2 weeks earlier came back to haunt him. Lieutenant Scheffel heard the news from wounded men who'd rejoined his unit.
They said, "Lieutenant, you won't believe this, but General Patton visited this hospital we were in and slapped these guys because they had combat fatigue." And I thought, well, the general must have just lost his cool to slap somebody.
George Patton did not believe that there was such a thing as combat fatigue. He thought that anybody who professed to have combat fatigue or bad nerves was probably just a malingerer or a coward or worse. He could be easily moved to tears by the sight of wounded men, and going to hospitals was always an emotional event for him anyway, but he clearly lost his temper.
Eisenhower and Marshall had to fight to even keep him from being relieved, sent home in disgrace once the incidents were made public.
Marshall left it up to Eisenhower whether or not to relieve Patton, but Eisenhower knew that Patton was one of his premier combat commanders and he would need him in Northwest Europe, and so put up with all the grief that he got.
Does he insist that Patton apologize?
In fact, Eisenhower does not insist that he apologize to everybody in Patton's whole organization. In essence, he'll apologize to the interested parties.
Patton ended up apologizing to his entire 7th Army.
This is a photo of Patton's 27 August apology to the 1st Infantry Division.
This is not what Eisenhower instructed him to do. Upon the advice of another general who was an old friend of his, it was thought that it would be better if he apologized to everyone.
Did people generally feel that Patton was warranted to have done what he did?
Well, due to the fact that there were some codebreakers, the GIs didn't really condemn Patton for what he did.
These incidents cost Patton his command. It cost, I believe, Patton the ground command for the cross-channel invasion, which I think was his for the taking. And instead it went to Bradley. So he was literally left behind on Sicily, left in the Mediterranean until early 1944.
The one thing never in question was Patton's faith in the American soldier. The lessons learned in Sicily would be put into practice throughout the remainder of the war. Men like Spears, Kuehl, and Sayre went on to fight in Italy. Stafford headed to the Pacific, and Scheffel and Van Wagner landed at Normandy.
When you look back at this campaign, it's very clear that the U.S. Army really did come of age, that we had shown that we were capable of being at least the equal, if not the better, of the British.
More than 5,000 Allied soldiers were killed in the 38 days of brutal fighting on Sicily. Another 17,000 were casualties. More than six decades later, paratrooper Timothy Dias was honored to have served.
These were men that were so great in their love of country and their willingness to fight for it that it was a pleasure just to be one of them and to be associated with them.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead on War Stories.
Before General Patton's troops landed on Sicily, he said, "Remember that we as the attackers have the initiative. We must retain this tremendous advantage by always attacking rapidly, ruthlessly, viciously, and without rest." And they did. After 38 days of nonstop fighting in some of the roughest terrain in the European theater, the island was finally secured. But the Allied victory was bittersweet. The successful withdrawal of some 100,000 Italian and German troops across the Straits of Messina would have repercussions until the end of the war. Today, combined force operations like the one in Sicily are still challenging, but in 1943, they were completely untested. The Sicily campaign was the first American airborne amphibious operation. The lessons learned then are still in use today. For those who served on, in the waters around, and the skies above Sicily, theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. For War Stories, I'm Oliver North. Good night.